We've been in 1 Samuel, and we're wrapping up for the semester, or for the season, I suppose. So we could just dive into the next chapter. But why don't we take a step back and kind of recap some of the things that we've seen, because we started it back in the spring. It sounds like Mike talked a little bit about different kinds of literature last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really helpful as you think through what we have here. Like, this is part of the former prophets, but why do they put it in the former prophets? Right, in our English Bibles, we put it in history. And so we stick it right next to, right, Samuel Kings, or right next to Chronicles. And that's really weird. Like, why would you do that? In the Hebrew Bible, they're separated. Because it's a different kind of literature, it's for a different purpose. That creates confusion for me after seminary. I have trouble finding Chronicles because I look for it in my English Bible where it should be in my Hebrew Bible, and I look for it in my Hebrew Bible where it should be in my English Bible. That's a mess. So, one of the things that we've seen as we've worked through Samuel, I think, is a cycle of rising and falling. So tell me more about that. What do you remember about what we've seen in that regard?
Saul's an obvious example.
Yeah, so Saul.
That, you know, Samuel, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Not Samuel himself, you know, he appoints his sons as priests to take over for him.
So Samuel and his sons. Yeah. Well, that's a good question. We definitely see David on the rise. Will we see David fall? But we begin, it begins even earlier. It's more kind of a, I guess the pattern is more a demise of someone and then a rise of someone else. So we see Eli. See, Eli seems to start this cycle. Tell me about the ways you've seen characters described. Right? We have this handout, the questions for careful readers, which kind of helps guide you into that. But what are the ways that you've noticed? Like, how do you see that someone's kind of in the midst of their demise versus on the rise? And how do you assess individual characters as we read? What kinds of clues does the narrator give you?
Well, with Saul, a lot of the things he said, like not that of people, but...
Yeah, so with Saul, we see some of his internal dialogue. We saw that especially in the last couple of chapters. As he's kind of psyching himself up against David, and he's frightened of David and what he represents. And initially, all that's internal dialogue, right? We see his outward actions. We see what he says. But there's a lot of internal dialogue that tells us, as the reader, what Saul's thinking and where he is with things that's obscured from the other characters. And then it becomes known among his officers, but still hidden from David and Jonathan. And then it becomes just full public knowledge. Good. So sometimes when we're assessing a character, we'll see internal dialogue. What else do we see? How do we know somebody's a good guy or a bad guy? Or that this was good or bad? What do we see with Eli? Let's go back to some of those early chapters. This was back in January or so. How do we know what's going on with Eli? So when we talked about Eli way back whenever that was, part of what we did was question what's going on with his sons. Have they just gone astray? Did he fail as a parent and as a priest in teaching them?
God holds him responsible. You know, yeah. You honor your sons,
This is true. So that's right. Sometimes we have an inkling of how we should take something, but we're not entirely sure. And then, right, God will speak and confirm. Or the narrator will kind of step out from behind the description of the story to tell you,
yeah,
and this was evil in the sight of the Lord. Something like that. Even earlier, though, or well, around that, what are some other things we see? If we go back to chapter 1. Right, Hannah comes. Hannah's in the midst of this distress. Hannah comes before Eli. Well, she comes to the tabernacle, or to the temple. And she's praying. And how does Eli respond? Eli just assumes she's drunk. Eli, who is this experienced priest who's been leading the people for some time, sees a woman who's distressed in soul, and his immediate assumption, right, is that she's had a little much. It is around feast time, right? And the narrator, in that sense, kind of parodies Eli. And there's this really interesting comment, something Hannah says in response to Eli. In verse 16 there, "Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman," which is exactly the way the narrator characterizes Eli's sons in chapter 2, verse 12. He says, "Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord." There's one of your rare direct statements. Mostly in Old Testament narrative, often in the New Testament as well, they're going to describe people's actions, and they'll let us see what they say, but they won't often say something so very direct as that. To say, "Now the sons of Eli were worthless men, they did not know the Lord." It's not that it never happens, it's that it's the less common way of characterizing someone, so it's definitely highlighting the evil of their actions. Good. So when we entered into the scene in Samuel, what about the way Samuel starts? What do we think of the book of Samuel as being about? Or who's its main character? Right? What happens in the history of Israel in the book of Samuel? Why do we need this book?
What's the real transition to a king?
Okay. The transition to a king. I love how you put that. Because you didn't go for the name of a character. What are ways that we've seen that in the chapters that we've gone over together? What are we transitioning from? We're transitioning from Judges. That's lowercase J, Judges. Had a series of judges. To a king. Did they have a king? It's a trick question. Yeah, it's a trick question. Answer it anyway.
Of course they did.
Yeah, Yahweh is their king, right? Which is pointed out in several places. And it comes up in chapter 8, right? When Samuel is so upset. Because they've asked for a king again. Because Samuel has tried to set his sons over Israel as judges in different places. And they, in many ways, remind us of Eli's sons and their behavior. So, where does it begin, though? If the book of Samuel is concerned about this transition to kingship, where our major figures, right, are Saul and David, and Samuel as kind of the bridge between the period of the judges and the period of the kings, and the one who brings us from one to the other. Where does it begin? Does the book of Samuel begin with some significant ceremony, or with like the birth of David? Where do we start?
Begins with a barren woman.
A barren woman in the context of a faithful Israelite family in the midst of their annual pilgrimage for worship. Does that sound familiar? A little bit? It doesn't begin on some big international scene. It begins in the midst of this little family with all of this internal strife going on between rival wives, one of whom is barren, who turns out to be Samuel's mother. Right? And then we go from there, right? But we don't go from there immediately to this international scene either, right? We follow the development as Samuel comes under Eli's tutelage, and we see, continuing over the course of that relationship, we see Eli in continued decline as Samuel, in ways that remind us of Luke's description of Jesus, right? He continues to grow in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Almost the same phrasing. We saw some other connections with Luke as well in those early chapters. Do you guys remember the major one? Another connection between Hannah and Mary. Hannah's song, her prayer in chapter 2, is very closely mirrored in the Magnificat, right? Mary's prayer in Luke chapter 1. Some of the same language and themes. It's not a one for one. Mary didn't just lift Hannah's words and make them her own. But there are several parallels. There are also ways in which Hannah's prayer here in chapter 2 give us glimpses of what's coming over the course of the book of Samuel. Yeah, there are some interesting parallels with Samson as well, if we back up into the book of Judges, right? Samson is kind of the ultimate judge we think of when we think of the judges, even though there are so many difficulties with Samson. He's such a complex character, but we begin, we approach Samson's reign as judge in a similar way, in the midst of this little Israelite family with a barren wife, and then an announcement there by an angel instead of by a priest. and then he grows, and then all of this, you know, everything unfolds over the course of his life. Which, if we come to Samuel fresh from Judges, I reckon has a couple of effects on us. As we start to read the book of Samuel, it's like, ooh, something exciting is going to happen. Oh, is it going to go like it went last time? Right? Is this going to be amazing or is this going to be awful? Is this going to be in some ways, is it going to be a great deliverance or a missed opportunity or kind of both? Both a great deliverance and a missed opportunity. So So we see that we see the demise of Eli paralleled with the rise of Samuel. We see the rise of Saul. And the interesting thing is the pattern's a little bit broken there because Samuel fades a bit, but he doesn't seem he doesn't seem to have the same kind of fall. There's trouble with his sons, which is part of what gives rise to this transition and the request for a king. But Samuel doesn't experience the same kind of demise that Eli does or that Saul does. So the pattern's somewhat broken in that transition between Samuel and Saul, which I think is deliberate on the part of the narrator, right? This is reporting what happened, but this is also shaping our view of things and giving us a certain interpretation. And I think that's a hint that there's something wrong. There's something wrong here. And then we see that pattern continue as Saul goes into decline and David's on the rise. And as Carol mentioned earlier, that leaves us with this expectation. What's going to happen with David? Are we going to notice as we continue through the book, will we notice this continued, right? Is David going to be on the decline then? And someone else going to rise to take their place, to take his place? Which, right, we want to watch for Absalom. And then later, as we transition to kings, we're going to want to watch with Adonijah and Solomon what's going to happen. And so does David experience the same kind of demise with the corresponding rise of another figure? Or is that another place where the pattern breaks? So we've also, as we've watched over these chapters, we've got all of this interaction between a prophet and a priest and a king. And often where there's trouble is where we have more than one of those offices embodied in one person. Right? If you think about where Saul first runs into trouble, it's when he either ignores Samuel or when he tries to take on priestly responsibilities in giving the offerings so that he can go on instead of waiting for Samuel to arise or to arrive. Right? We see in Samuel the office of prophet, the office of priest, and almost the desire to act as a king. And that seems he's not a king. He's never given the position of a king. But he installs his sons in leadership over Israel, which presents this hint of dynasty, right? He's leading the nation and he's offended when they ask for a king. And that leaves us wondering as well, what's going to happen with these themes of prophet, priest, and king as we continue to read? Is this a place where David's going to run into trouble? Or will we have a separation of branches, so to speak, during David's reign? So, as we continue to read Samuel. We begin, especially with Eli, the text raises this question, who is the faithful priest? Right? Eli's not. And we see that. So when will we get a faithful priest? Who's the faithful king? Right? We begin without one. We get Saul. He's not the faithful king. At the point where we are in the book, we don't yet have a faithful king. We have a second anointed who's not yet been able to reign as king. Once he does, will he reign as a faithful king? And in the midst of that, there's a question of prophet, right? Who is the prophet that the Lord's people should listen to? So we could phrase it the same way. Who's the faithful prophet in Israel at this time? I think one thing that we've noticed that's come up at several points, right? References back to Leviticus with Eli's sons, references back to Deuteronomy and this idea of a new Moses in the way Samuel is described and spoken about. In order to read the former prophets well, we need to know the Torah. We need to know the Pentateuch, right? what reinforces our reading of the prophets? Knowing the law. And then what helps in our understanding of the law? Well, knowing the prophets. What do we do with wisdom literature, which seems in some respects to be its own alien thing? Well, do we know the Torah? Do we know the prophets, right? Scripture helps us interpret Scripture. Scripture helps us read Scripture. Knowing the Old Testament well in all of these respects helps us pick up on so much of what the New Testament is doing. Even Mark 1, Jesus' interaction with the leper, right? If we don't know the laws surrounding leprosy from Leviticus, then we go to read Jesus' interaction with the leper and we don't get it. Right? That Jesus actually has to become unclean. Right? Ceremonially unclean and touching the leper in order for that leper to be healed. Right? And Mark is playing on Leviticus to give us foreshadowing of what Jesus will do on the cross. So, Mike, would you add anything? Mm-hmm. I saw a little bit on the board, yeah. Yeah, we have that question around Samuel, right? Is he doesn't seem to be a Levite, but yeah, he's taking on these priestly functions. And why is that acceptable?
Yeah, and I'm not taking issue with what you said about the king not being king. He's not, there isn't an office of king until Saul. But he is a judge. He's the last judge.
Yes. Yes.
It's not a final solution. It points out the need for a king. So
yeah.
I think part of the answer is that Samuel is one of those unique figures that's a Christ figure.
Mm-hmm.
Because he embodies, in some sense, all three offices, even though he's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It interacts with the question of whether Samuel is a new Moses. Because Moses is the last time we've seen these three offices combined, prophet, priest, and king, in one person. And Samuel seems to do some of those things. And some of the particular language, even at the end of chapter 4, or chapter 3, and Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. That's 3 verses 19 and 20. If you reflect back on Deuteronomy 18, 15 through 22, right? You read that and you think, oh, is this is definitely a new Moses. Is this the new Moses? And again, right, then we come forward to the New Testament and we see Jesus fulfilling those things. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when he also prays for one of the kings who takes Sarah into his harem for a bit.
Right.
Yeah.
And then David's called a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
He's obviously a king. And the whole scene when the ark is brought in, he's wearing a linen ephod, and he is bringing the ark to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so David's essentially leading the priestly procession that brings the ark in. So,
you know, you have these major figures, and because they're Christ figures, even though they may be a king or they may occupy one office, like Samuel, an official office, or a prophet,
It kind of seems like one of the big differences with the king and judge is that there's no succession, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to be the major distinction, right? A judge leads Israel in ways a king might, but the office is temporary. It's often in response to a specific threat. And there's no expectation of a dynasty. And in fact, in Judges, we run into trouble when a judge tries to set up a dynasty. And that, I think, was where I was getting my comment that Samuel seems to want kingly power, is when he installs his sons. Right? So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Christ is one who continues on the throne.
I think too,
go for it.
So there's the deal with his sons, but there's also this ironic, the people ask for a king, and Samuel's distressed. Distressed rightly because they're asking for the wrong reason. They're asking for a king like the other nations have. And there, in a nutshell, is the whole issue of Scripture.
Yeah. It's like they need a Saul to appreciate God's choice of a king. Because although David shows himself to be an able king, Saul is the one who looks the part. He's a head taller than everybody else. He comes from a well-off family.
Yeah.
Of all his brothers, David looked least the part.
I was listening last night, and R.C. Sproul was talking about that passage. And he asked a question, I thought it was a great question, because the way God does things,
Mm-hmm. But it's meant to teach us a lesson. The drama of it is meant to impress certain things on us.
Yeah.
It wouldn't come across if you'd done it another way. And in some sense, I think we can look at that in a wider sense. That's why God didn't send redemption into the world. It's the whole reason for redemptive history. It's a drama that I believe we will always look back on for eternity. As we make this point, it's a cool point to see. God does what he does for a reason. It's not the way we would be thinking. It's always there.
Yeah.
It's always there.
Yeah. It says,
quick question.
Yes.
You mentioned Saul was from a well-to-do family, but he talks about his family as being the least of, you know, was that just a little bit of...
Saul does, yeah. So I think Saul's from a well-off family. And part of that is he has these donkeys that go missing, and his family has the resources to kind of be without Saul and the fellow who goes with him for an extended period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, he tears down the altar and sacrifices a whole bunch of oxen. So, yes, and he speaks, I think maybe with a little bit of false humility. It's, no, all right, I'm not fit for this. Who am I? Who's my family? But that doesn't seem to actually be the case. So, yeah. As for the people of Israel and Samuel and trying to find a king, it does seem like everybody's looking for a king in all the wrong places. So, whereas God is at work from well before they even ask to bring this thing about, because it's been a part of his plan. And we've had hints of that from all the way back in Genesis. Genesis 49. Right? That the scepter will not depart from Judah. So...
Mm-hmm. Possibly germane in this conversation, but I was just thinking about way back when they lose the ark to the Philistines. And then when the Philistines decide they better give it back, or else the Philistines recognize when God had come to Egypt, and didn't want it to be done again. It's also like they also recognize that Israel was with very loyal to their God.
Yeah, there's an implicit critique of the Israelites in the Philistines' recognition of Yahweh's power as they interact with the Ark. Right? It's this captured war trophy that puts them in fear because of its power. And it's also another example of where we see the people trying to do things one way instead of God's way, and God accomplishing things without their help. Thank you very much. He allows his ark to be captured, the symbol of his presence with his people, so that the Israelites are saying the glory has departed, right? Ichabod. But as the ark makes its way through Philistine territory, it routs the Philistines without the Israelite army. So much of what we have is a contrast between the way the people or individual figures want to bring things about versus God's design and God's plan that's always been at work and continues to advance despite people's attempts to frustrate it. A couple of other asides. Mike mentioned, right, things seem to happen differently with Abraham, and it's before the law, but he embodies these ideals of prophet, priest, and king. There are several places in Genesis in particular where things seem a little bit weird in light of later scripture. There's a fantastic book by, I think it's Walter Moberly. It's called The Old Testament of the Old Testament. And he looks at the stories of the patriarchs on the analogy of, you know, the Old Testament seems a little bit weird in light of New Testament development. Well, and stuff with the patriarchs seems a little bit weird in light of later Old Testament development. But that helps us understand some of the the nuance, like what's going on with the patriarchs and how things change with the coming of the law. So again, that's the Old Testament of the Old Testament. Something that I found really helpful a number of years ago. So there's a line that comes out of higher criticism and of the 19th century. That the shortened version is the law is later than the prophets. And there are good reasons that these people brought forward for thinking so. And one of the lines of reasoning was that thinking of the cult, the temple cult in particular, the daily service of worship and offerings, this would have been a daily living reality, right, up until the exile. So some of these fellows look at Ezekiel and how he describes the new temple. And then they look at Leviticus and how it describes the sacrificial system. And there are differences. And they say, ah, right? Ezekiel felt the need to write this down as a priest because he wasn't able to do his daily work in the temple because it had been destroyed and he's in exile. So this is the thing. And then the Pentateuch is like made up stuff later. And that's the reason that they don't match. Right? Instead of this idea that, well, maybe the reason they don't, right? The new temple is new and there are some new things about it. It's not an altogether unreasonable position, but I think as you read more, it falls apart. And I think we're seeing in Samuel, one of the ways that comes to light most clearly is that in order to understand Samuel, you have to know the Pentateuch. Right? In order to read the prophets well and understand what they're upset about and why they are prosecuting Israel, right, you have to have a law code that happens on the basis of. And so much, again, that's just one more way that we see the Scripture helps us interpret Scripture, and that reading over here helps us understand the nuance of what's being presented here, and the nuance of what's presented here and how that thing plays out helps us understand the importance of these things. So as we take a break for a month or so and return in January, I'd encourage you, right? It's a thing, right, around New Year's to start a new Bible reading plan, which usually dies. I find that the place where mine falls apart is usually the second half of Exodus, right? Because I read the instructions for the building of the tabernacle, and then I read about the golden calf. And then I've made it through the instructions because I know the golden calf is coming. But then you get chapter after chapter where they follow the instructions for building. Like, I just read this. Here it was do this, and here it's they did this. And then, right, if you make it through that, you get Leviticus. And if you make it through Leviticus, your reward is a book named Numbers. This should be called In the Wilderness, right? But I'd encourage you maybe to start a plan now. Instead of waiting until January, right? Who cares about the calendar year, right? And just read. Read as much as you can. Read in big chunks, read in small chunks, and then listen. As we move through Advent, as we read the Christmas story, right? How are these things that you're reading from early chapters in the Old Testament, how are they reflected? How are they showing up in the coming of the Christ? And then bring those observations with you as we come back in January and restart CE. So.
Yeah, one thing to that.
Yes, Mike.